young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll free anytime, 1-888-429-5471.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet and you meet.
Farhan Dalla with us. He's the creator of the DVD Mind, Ball, and Soul. He's a spiritual personal trainer whose mission in life is to help those who see their value, those to see their value and their worthiness. He began his career as a physical therapist, working with world-famous athletes. He now offers people a way to succeed in their goals through intuitive readings, Reiki, heart resonance therapy, and psychotherapy. He's earned worldwide recognition as a former Reebok master trainer, international fitness presenter, and has spoken at some of the world's largest fitness conferences. And let us say, Farhan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about spirituality...
My pleasure.
Yeah. Oh, and thank you. When we talk about spirituality, how does someone touch that? How does somebody know when they are touching their own essence, their own core, and at the same time keep it integrated with the body?
Right. Well, I think let's look at what the word spirit means. And for them, because sometimes when people hear the word spirituality, they kind of get a bit nervous about it and think there's some religious connotation to it. And first of all, let me explain that that's not the case. Everybody has a spirit. And if you compare it analogous to a car, if you look at us like a car, our physical body represents that aspect of the body of the car. The soul is not like the spirit. I like to call the soul as the steering wheel, which is guiding us. And the spirit is what I refer to as the fuel that moves us.
Okay, but let me ask you. Yeah, absolutely. And let me ask you this. Is some of the problems that we run into when we block the guide, when we mask ourselves, we hide ourselves, and we don't let that guide us to where we're supposed to be?
Right. So that's where I come in. And usually that's the case of what I call spiritual anorexia. And the spirit is that aspect of ourselves that makes us feel good. It's our positive thoughts, our actions, the environment that we surround ourselves in. It's all those things that make us feel good. And it's oftentimes that when we're suffering from negative thoughts, blocks in our lives that prevent us from feeling that spirit, which inevitably prevents us from receiving that information that you're referring to as guidance.
Okay, so let's say, for instance, in athletics, to really be your absolute best, if you can unblock that whatever that is, that wall between your spirit and your physical body, so if you connect the two, you do better. But if you move that same thing into business and in a relationship, isn't it all the same process? Just depends where you want to put it.
Absolutely. It can be applied to every aspect of your life, not just the physical. And that's one of the reasons why I find the term... physical therapy so limiting, but like you described in my bio, I now apply those principles to help people in every aspect of their life, whether it's in their career, their relationship, or with themselves.
Okay, well let's go to you personally. You struggled with weight a great
portion
of your life, and then you found your voice, your own guide, your own spirit. Where was that connection for you, and then how did the weight start to come off?
The first thing that I learned was my mirror was either my friend or my enemy. And so I started to make connections with the awareness of how I felt about myself every time I looked at myself in a mirror. And so I was given an exercise by a very wise person who said, the next time you look in a mirror, I want you to point at something only positive. Okay? And so it started from there, and I started to make the connection that if I programmed myself by focusing on what feels good and the positive aspects of my physical being, then when I went into the gym and I started working out, I was now treating my body with a different perception, not because of what I didn't like, but because of what I liked, and also because of the way I was treating and respecting myself. And then what I noticed is that the results were a little more permanent. And not just that, but I wasn't depending also about the way that I looked in order to feel good about myself, but I was actually feeding myself those positive self-messages that were coming directly from me.
Now, by the way, when you talk about the positive self-messages, something called an affirmation in and of its own way is also a positive self-message. But for many, many people that I ran into in a long period of time, the affirmation or the positive self-message was nothing more than discovering what's underneath causing that to stop. And when we feed ourselves a positive message, and we're frightened to death of it because it may open us up to something, even if it's good, that we're not comfortable with, it's not known, we block it and we fight it. So realistically, isn't it a lot discovery? And if you could just grit your teeth, bite your tongue, and let it happen, the world can open up for you.
You know, and I tell people this, you don't necessarily have to believe the affirmation when you first start to work with it. And yes, there is a whole slew of things to uncover once you begin that process, because what you're saying is that I'm opening the crack and I'm allowing eventually for that door to open. But you often have to sit there and think about, you know, what resonates with you as well. And, you know, if you're having difficulty, for example, you know, and if you're 80 pounds overweight and you're looking in the mirror and it's hard to come up with that positive phrase, you can start with something that says you're in the process of getting to that goal. So, for example, you can look in the mirror and say, I'm in the process of making my body better, as opposed to, I love what I'm seeing. Do you see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So it makes it easier to take that affirmation and add the vibration of, yes, I believe what I'm saying to be true, and then in the process of the journey to come up with other ones as the physical changes are taking place.
Sure, and it becomes something that's manageable, that's something, it's a realistic goal, and I think that's where most people get blocked. Farhan, I think they take on a goal that is way beyond their ability to deal with whatever life is or their objectives are, and they end up failing. And inside is nothing
right.
more than validating to themselves that they couldn't do it in the first place. So, quote unquote, in one way, they win, but it's stepping beyond that and realizing that there are things that you can accomplish, but you can't get hit with it all at once.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Michael, there's, you know, when I talked about spirit as being fuel, well, there's good fuel and then there's bad fuel. And you have a choice about what type of fuel you're going to feed yourself with. And consequence to some of the negative ones, for example, you know, do you know why Mondays are the busiest days in the gym? It's because of what people ate and drank over the weekend. Okay,
yeah.
So the driving force or the fuel to get them there is guilt and anger. Okay, so
sure.
They may temporarily feel better about themselves because they're now at the gym as a consequence to their actions on the weekends, but their overall results, they're setting themselves up for complete failure. Plus, they haven't done anything to make themselves really feel good about themselves because they fed themselves with bad fuel. See what I'm saying?
Sure. No, absolutely, no question about it. And if you talk about guilt and anger, if you get down and you define it, anger is nothing more than blocked expression. Farhan, we've never been mad at
yeah.
anybody who's agreed with us. So you block it, you internalize it, and the problems start. Guilt is something that you don't think you should have done any way you look at it. You combine the two together, and you see most of the people walking up and down the streets. That's what they're made of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's guilt and anger are probably two of the most negative vibrationally energetic forms of energy that's out there that are the most detrimental to us.
Sure, and
with
fear,
both emotional and physical consequences.
Sure, and fear is another one. Fear, I think, is a major one, and it's not so much fear of not accomplishing a goal. There's fear of accomplishing the goal. What is that old adage? Better unhappy than unsure. And people are frightened to death of the unknown. And the walk into the next room can be an absolute unknown. But if you're comfortable with yourself,
yeah.
how you'll respond to whatever comes up, then things become unknown very quickly.
Absolutely. And my job as a spiritual personal trainer is to try to help people discover what that fear is, because sometimes people don't even know what their fears are.
No, absolutely not. By the way, when we talk the word, you know, you work with people intuitively. What does that mean? Define that so we know what we're working with.
Absolutely. I have a bag of tools that I'm trained in. And so I've trained with a variety of well-known, I want to say the word psychic and intuitives that are out there right now who have been amazing teachers in my life, who have allowed me to develop that that other sense, that sixth sense, that sense that we all have.
Yeah.
And I use that as my guiding source when I'm working with my clients. So, you know, call it tapping into something, plugging into something other than, you know, my physical body, enabling to help unlayer what I'm seeing at the surface when people are talking to me to give them a better idea of what's happening at the deeper core.
So in essence, you have to become who you're working with. You have to see the world through their eyes.
Yes and no. I mean, pardon me?
I said you have to see the world through their eyes before you can work with them to know what really is going on with them. That's what I mean.
Yeah, I'm kind of stepping into their soul, and I'm using my intuitive skills to direct me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, it's when I say becoming them, when they walk out with them. But the point of contention is that you have to think like them. You have to experience the world like they do before you can actually tap in and say, let's look at this a little differently or whatever it is that you're dealing with at the time.
Right, absolutely. And it can be very intense work because when I'm doing this type of things, I'm getting to that place with that person where it probably hurts the most and is so raw. And, you know, there's possibly so many layers of stuff covering it all up that it's almost like what I call doing psychic surgery, where we have to kind of cut through the layers and get to that place where it's most uncomfortable in order for us to get to what we need to do to resolve the issue and free the block or release the anger or uncover the grief, whatever it is.
Now, when you're dealing with people, now, obviously, you can't deal with everybody at one time. So the CD, the DVD, the DVD in and of itself, is that like working with you?
Yes, it's working with me on the physical and the mind and the spiritual aspect, absolutely. And the DVD is an integrative approach, yet a holistic approach to working out where I've taken strength training combined with specific yoga postures, as well as core training, using my knowledge as a physical therapist with the ball, and I brought it all together. I used my knowledge as a physical therapist to see how the core functions as an important stabilizer in the body, and strength training is so important. It's an important aspect of our training because of multiple reasons, as far as with the aging population alone, keeping our muscles and bones strong. And then what I saw in the industry, what was happening is that people who did yoga didn't necessarily did strength training and vice versa, because let's face it, you only have so many hours in a day. And you can't necessarily fit all of that into one workout. And I looked at all the different programs and I put it together to really give you a complete holistic workout. Now, every time you do a move in my workout, when you're doing one exercise, you're using every single muscle in your body, okay? Whereas if you were to go to the gym, you might work on your arm, you might work on your chest, you might work on your legs. But in every single move that you do in this workout, you're using every muscle in your body. And the benefit that is that it affects us in the way that we live in our everyday lives, because every action requires multiple muscles to work together, right?
Okay, yeah, but let me hold you up just for a second. Now, when you on a practical level, so we can get an image of this, what does it look like to have to move all the muscles at the same time? What are we doing? Just one example.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so if you imagine you're holding the ball in front of you, I mimic a functional activity where you pick something off the floor and then you put it up on the shelf. So right away, as you're squatting, you're using all the muscles in your legs. As you're holding the ball, you're using the muscles in your core to stabilize. And then with your arms, as you start to straighten up through the legs, you're placing the ball, imagining that you're placing it up on the shelf. But then what I do is I layer the movement to incorporate it as a three-dimensional pattern, because rarely are our movements in two-dimensional planes, always lifting and then slightly rotating. Perhaps we have to put that that book up on the shelf, but slightly over to the left, and then perhaps you want to lift and move that book slightly over to the right. So I incorporate the three-dimensional aspects of movement into every movement pattern, and that's part of the warm-up.
So we're using our legs, we're using our glutes, we're using our abs, we're using our chest, we're using our shoulders through the entire thing.
You're using all your muscles, exactly.
Yeah. Okay,
the,
see, that makes sense.
Most part of the workout is if you... Sorry?
I'm saying most people don't do that. They're not even aware that that's really what you should be doing in a workout.
Well, I'll explain it to you like this. If you were to take every one of your muscles, and let's just pretend that they were in a member of a band, so your biceps were like the trumpet, and your quadriceps were the drums, and your calves were the guitar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you told all those members of the band to work out or play their instrument and practice separately, and then on opening night, when the brain, the conductor, brings all those members of the band together and say, okay, one, two, three, everybody play together now, how do you think that band's going to sound?
Yeah,
and
no, I got you loud and clear.
This is what we do in the gym. Pardon me?
Okay. I got you loud and clear. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Where can we find you? Can you give us your website where we can get the DVD and get more information?
Absolutely. My DVD is available on Amazon.com. When you go to the search engine, just type in Mind, Ball, and Soul. And you can also contact me and get more information about spiritual personal training on my website at farhandala.com. And if you're going to be posting that on your website.
If anybody missed it, it'll be up on our website. So it's going to be up there.
Fantastic.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I think you're spot on with exactly what you're doing, and more people should get involved in it, because realistically, if you do what you're talking about doing, it can improve a personality, it can improve the way of life and the outlook on life also, which is critical. How you get up in the morning is how your day is going to be.
Exactly. So start your day off with a positive thought, and the best one I like is the one by Louise Hay, and my first thought every morning is, life loves me.
Yeah, gotcha. Loud and clear. Okay, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Michael. I really appreciate it. That was a great, great, great chat.
Oh, my pleasure. Good night.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. If you want to join us, 1-888-429-5471. 1-888-429-5471. Shelly Storr with us. She's the author of Somebody's Daughter, a novel about date rape. She's authored 4 award-winning novels for young adults. She's appeared on many, many radio and TV programs, including Maury Povich's show. And let us say, Shelly, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we talk about date rape today. I was looking at your press release, and my goodness, one thing here. It was, what was it? More than 1/3 of American girls will be raped between the ages of 14 and 17 years old. Shelly, what do you think causes this? You know, I came from an era 200 years ago where, you know, there were rapes. There was no question about it, but nothing like the amount that there is today. And the sexuality was not near anything that it is today. I'm not a moralist, but I'm a pragmatist more than anything else. And, you know, we look at this, time and again, you hear young women say, well, we're going to go out and get hooked up tonight. It's almost at a point now where you would think, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not 20 years old and I don't go out with 20-year-olds, but stop me if I'm wrong, but you would almost think if you go out with somebody, you're almost guaranteed to end up in bed with them.
Well, you know, I'm about 100 years old at least.
Ah,
so,
gotcha.
You know, I can speak a little to your experience.
Okay.
And actually disagree with you on that, because in my youth, it wasn't put out there as much by the media, but this stuff was still happening.
Yeah.
So, I think that that the sexuality of teenagers has always been there. We hear more about it now. And so far as date rape goes and why that happens, you know, we're dealing with two things. One is from the girls' end. Girls are not knowing how to protect themselves. And we can tell our teenagers, you know, don't go to a party and get drunk, because alcohol is the number one date rape drug. But, you know, is that really realistic for our teenagers? The important thing, and, you know, the message that I try and get out with all of my books for adults is communication. How do we communicate with our teens? And that's why I write fiction, is so that it's a good way to open up communication in a non-threatening manner.
Oh, sure.
Now, on the other hand, we have the boys. You were saying?
No, I said no question. I was agreeing with you.
Yeah. On the other hand, we have the young men. And really, they're as much at risk. And I can't say as much at risk, but they are at risk with date rape as well. I'm not saying of being raped, but rather of actually raping a young woman and thinking that that young woman was willing because she was drunk.
Yeah.
This brings me back to my first novel. There was a scene where a young girl is, she gets very drunk at a party. She goes upstairs, she's followed upstairs, and she's raped. Now, to me, she was raped. A male relative of mine read that same scene and said, oh, it was so real, because it's just exactly how you have sex the first time. You get a girl drunk, you get her upstairs, and you have sex with her. And I was shocked at the time. I thought, well, that's not consensual sex. Mm-hmm. Well, now the law is on the side of that not being consensual sex. So that has changed. The laws have changed.
Let me tell you how extreme the law is today. That if you're having sex with someone, and right at that moment of climax, right before that, if you say no before that happens, right at that moment, then it goes from consensual sex to rape. So rape can happen any time during that period of time. Now, we're talking about kids, and we're talking about something that shouldn't happen, and we're talking about something that you know, we're brought up in a culture where you got sex all over the place. There's got to be some control someplace, and that doesn't come from any moralist or religious point of view. It comes from being a human being, my goodness already.
Well, let me tell you also that the law says that if the woman or girl, and I deal with teenagers, so I'll say the girl, if the girl is impaired in any way, including drunk, then it's automatically a rape, because as a drunk person, she cannot legally give consent. That didn't used to be the case, but it is now. And so, you know, there are things that we need to do to tell our children, to open up communication with our children about these, about what the law is, and also to tell our daughters that they don't get into a situation with what I would call an opportunist, not a predator. When we're dealing with adults, we're often dealing with a predator, a sexual predator. When we're dealing with teenagers, we're usually dealing with not predators, but opportunists who see, who are, you know, you have boys who are shy and awkward and don't, wouldn't, you know, they have hormones raging, but they have no idea how to use them.
Sure.
So, you know, in a social situation where there's been some alcohol, then, you know, everyone loosens up and then it seems to be okay, but it's actually not. And we need to be clear with our sons to protect them from the accusations of rape, as much as we need to be clear with our daughters how to protect themselves from rape.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you, because if somebody says, I was drunk, that, you know, I was drunk and I had sex, rape is rape any way you take a look at it, and being drunk is no excuse.
No, no, it's not. But, you know, one of the things that I say as advice to young women, one of the things that I would say is, first of all, I talked about communication before. And communication with within one's social peers is important as well. So that the people that you're going out with know what your views are. You know, your friends know how you feel about premarital sex, or, you know, and they're going to stand by you. Another thing is, and again, you know, avoid alcohol and drugs is going to help you out tremendously, but teenagers going to a party with no adult supervision, I don't have high expectations of there not being alcohol at that party.
Okay, Shelley, let me hold you up. Let's create a scenario here, okay? Let's create a scenario. The and here's the scenario. I have a daughter, 17 years old, hypothetically. What do I do? What do I have to tell her? Or what do I alert her to so she'll know what to look for? Because if she can anticipate ahead of time, that's going to help. That won't mean it won't happen, but it will help a great percentage. So what do I sit down and talk to her about, and what do I tell her to look out for?
Okay, I want to, you know, all right, let's say it's my daughter. I would want to tell her to avoid drinking too much. I would want to tell her, number one, stay with the pack. Stay with a group. If you're stay with the group, you're not going to get raped. I would say talk to your date beforehand if you're going with a date. Make sure that your date and you are on the same page. I would say don't go back to someone's room or leave a party with someone that you don't know well. And that goes back again to stay with the group. I would say trust your gut. And if you feel at all uncomfortable, get the heck out of that situation. And along those lines, make sure you have an out. It can't always be the person that you came with. I know a girl who went to a party, and she was with a relative. The relative was her ride. She drank some alcohol, and she actually smoked some pot as well, and ended up in a situation. Her friend went home, and she was left alone at this party with no way, she thought, to get home. And consequently, she was invited, sort of coerced into a private room, and she was raped, gang raped, as happens in my book, Somebody's Daughter. The character is raped multiple times. Her ride left. So you need to have a secondary out. You need to either have your parents on call or a sister on call or someone that you're going to be able to call. You need to have two friends with you. Both of them have cars, you know, so that's really important. Stay with the pack and always have an out.
Yeah, and by the way, there is one other thing to take a look at here. You know, the step beyond date rape. There's a lot of young women that get murdered, too. So this advice that you're giving, these warning signals, quote unquote, or what to say, would help in any given situation. I think people are frightened to death today. They're going out with somebody for the first time and say, here are the rules, and here's how it goes. They're frightened to death to do that, and that really what should happen today. We live in a very, what's the word I want to use? I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember what I want to say. But, but a very confused world out there, and people are frightened to death to open their mouth.
Yeah, people are, and they always have been. And that's why communicating with our daughters is a lesson in itself. It's a lesson in communication so that they learn how to talk to people. If we don't talk to our kids, they're not going to be able to talk to their peers or to another authority figure. Let's say something does happen. Then what do you do? You know, and I'll just actually go through that. You know, if something does happen, you call a rape crisis hotline. That phone number I want to put out there is 1-800-799-SAFE. You want to get to an emergency room. You want to call a trusted friend or relative you can talk to. Trusted friend or relative or even a teacher. That's part of the communication, and that's probably the number one message that I want to get out there is communication with our young people, and that's why I write young adult novels to assist in that communication. I also write young adult novels in order to show teenagers I am not alone.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing. You know, if teenagers can communicate with each other, they can feel that they're not alone. When I wrote this book, I was shocked at the response, at how many people had experienced, I mean, in the book, there's a gang rape, and it seems like, well, this would be a very unusual experience. And I've had so many people come to me and say, oh, that happened to me when I was in high school. And the stories are just, you know, are crushing.
Sure.
I know of one girl who went to a party when she was 13 years old, and she went with a friend. And it was at a neighborhood boy's house, but there were older boys there, and they got to the party. It was just the two of them. Now, right there, that's a trust your gut thing. If you're the only two girls at the party, it's time to get out of there.
You bet.
But they stayed. They were 13, you know, and didn't think that they were at risk because they knew this neighborhood boy. Well, what happened was the, you know, wine started getting passed around, and they got drunk. My friend was asked by this neighborhood boy, hey, why don't we go outside for a while? So she went outside with him. Meanwhile, her friend was gang raped by the group of boys remaining at the party. I mean, it's just the truth is stranger than fiction, really.
Well, sure. Now, and when you would think about logic, you know, I'm standing there with four or five guys, and I think, okay, this is going to be a great thing to do. But what about the consequence? Why have to spend many years in jail, go through whatever there is to go through, become a sex offender? And, I mean, this list goes on and on. Those guys are not thinking about consequence for the action.
No, they're not. And, you know, that's why when I say alcohol is the number one date rape drug, it's not just the girls who are getting drunk. It's the boys who are getting drunk, and then they're not thinking clearly either. Neither side is thinking clearly. So it's the statistics are something like 70% of rapes occur when one or the other or both of the victim and the assailant have been drinking. So it's not always just the victim that's been drinking. It's often the assailant, too. So you have to tell your boys, too, to be careful of how much you drink and to only go to parties where people share your values. Same thing goes for the girls, where people share your values. This doesn't mean that you're not going to have sex. Maybe your values say, yes, I'm going to go to a party, and my intention is to hook up. But that's not to hook up.
Yeah, but the key is, if your intention is to hook up, then it's not rape. You don't have to worry about it. Go get in trouble. But if you don't want to be raped, that's the other side of it. Shelly, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. It's www.shellystoer.com. It's shelleystoer.com. If you want to find my book, the easiest way I'd say is to go to amazon.com and look for Somebody's Daughter. There are a couple of books with that title. Look for the one with the bright red cover.
Wonderful. Hey, Shelly, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
It's been a pleasure. Good night.
You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and
want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you gon' get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I'd do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us 1-888-429-5471 if you want to join in. Mark Brown with his PhD, Dr. Mark Brown. He's the author of Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness. He's been a longtime student of enlightenment, and although he's now written a definitive book on the subject, he says that when it comes to living in an enlightened way, there's always room to grow. And unlike his previous book on personal growth, his latest book, Live Like a Window, Work Like a Mirror, Enlightenment and the Practice of Eternity Consciousness, was not born from his years as a psychologist or from personal experience. Listen to it closely. It came to me one of those fortuitous life-enhancing insights we occasionally receive, then I'm more happier than ever before sharing it. And let's say, Mark Brown, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Isn't that the way life happens? One of the, you know, those emotional connected moments, that aha, wow moment, when all of a sudden you see the world in a completely different way and you weren't even expecting it to happen.
Well, that was certainly the case with this. I'd read the, and like with Enlightenment, for example, I'd read the literature for 20 years. But even after a lot of reading, I could not have told you what Enlightenment meant. And honestly, one Sunday morning, I went out on my porch with a cup of coffee, the time I usually reserve for doing crossword puzzles.
Yeah.
This time I went out with a legal pad, and for the next 2 weeks of Sunday mornings, I wrote 4 legal pads full of the content and the title of this book. And all of it was information that was new to me. I just wrote with, I guess you would call it faith in what was being, I call it downloaded to me.
Sure.
And after that, because it was such new material, I had to spend weeks and weeks and weeks sorting through it to get a handle on it to begin to write this book. But new ideas for me.
What is a window? And, you know, live like a window, but what is a window?
The idea is not the window per se, but the space. So if you imagine a window, a couple of hinges on one side and a latch on another, with the glass closed, light and color might come through. But if you open that glass and it becomes just this open space, then potentially anything can pass through. And when we're talking about living a happier, more serene, enlightened life, in this instance, what we're talking about is anything that comes into awareness, anything that comes into consciousness, allowing that to come up rather than clinging to any of it, allowing it to pass as through an open window. So living like a window is almost literally what it sounds like.
Yeah. No, by the way, work like a mirror. Would a mirror be a reflection of yourself, constantly keep you focused, constantly keep you aware of what you're doing and being intentional in your life?
Actually, the mirror is something, it would be a looking glass that you would hold out in front of you so that anybody looking at you wouldn't see anything but his or her reflection of him or herself. So the idea of living like a, working like a mirror is that you allow the world and all the people in it to reflect themselves just as they are, not as you wish them to be. So you're keeping yourself out of it.
Okay, so you're on the other side of the mirror. You are actually, quote-unquote, the mirror, and they're reflecting themselves through what they see in you.
Well, no, you're behind the mirror. So, yeah, they're not. You're not actually involved in this. You're just not
protecting
yourself.
Okay, well, let me make sure I got you. But the mirror in and of itself, it's you're standing there and you've got the mirror, but they're looking in the mirror, and what they're saying, they're reflecting themselves. Again,
themselves.
You said it. It's got nothing to do with you.
Correct.
It's what they reflect.
That's correct. So it's not what I want somebody to be or what I need somebody to be. It's that person in my presence getting to be just who they are.
Yeah, and then you can make your choice of get out of there quick or stay.
You can. You sure can, yes.
True. Okay. Now, by the way, enlightenment in and of itself, we've heard this word tossed around, bannered about, and used for so many years, and there's so much, it seems like it's that elusive something you just can't get your hands on or get your mind or emotions wrapped around. So let's define it and say, what is enlightenment? And then we've got something, a model to work with.
Okay. Well, in the first place, it's not something that a special few people get to attain or know about. It's not a special knowledge. It's not a special state. It's not mystical or magical. It's actually just an extension of an ability that all of us have. Enlightenment, I think about it in two ways. One, pretty informally, I think about it as lightening up, having a lighter spirit, becoming lighter by way of not being bogged down by human drama. But in a more formal sense, it's taking our ability to be aware, self-aware, which we have in a way that no other living creatures have, and expanding on that so that not only are we aware of ourselves, but we actually are looking from the outside in, watching ourselves as we live our lives from a position where we can comment on what's going on, and extending that awareness to a place where we no longer even comment on ourselves. Instead, we just watch what happens, and we live in a window-like way. We watch what comes up, and instead of commenting on it, judging it, making comparisons with it, we let it all pass. And, you know, if you think about that, just letting what comes up into awareness, pure, non-judgmental awareness, pass through this open space, it just feels peaceful and serene.
But well, let's talk about judgments for a moment. And what I've, Mark, what I've experienced with what a judgment is, if I'm going to judge you for something, I don't like the way you talk, I don't like the way you look, I don't like something, I'm going to judge you about that. Am I judging you, or am I really doing that reflection and judging myself? And if we don't get that and we don't turn that corner, we're always pointing a finger at somebody else, and that finger pointing is nothing more than a reflection of yourself. You're recognizing what you do or you don't like about yourself within that other person.
Yeah, that's part of what's behind the concept of projection, that we're projecting our own stuff into that person. In fact, that's one of the values of working like a mirror, that we just don't do that. We, you know, we leave people alone. We allow them to be who they are. It's our nature to make judgments. And it's part of how we survive. So our brains want to do it. It comes naturally to us. And there's value in it. You know, we have to make evaluations of things in order to decide what are good circumstances for us or who are good people to be around. But the kind of judging where, you know, you're trying to find something about somebody that maybe would make you feel superior, I think that may be a little more what you're talking about. And that's something that would be important to work on so that you are in relationships in a non-judgmental way. People don't feel that you're looking at them in a critical fashion. But the enlightened perspective actually goes beyond that. In a sense, if you were feeling judgmental about somebody because you have the ability to step back and actually watch yourself being judgmental, what you would do is you would allow that judgmentalness itself to come up and not even do anything with that, just let it pass through. Now, if you do that, you're not going to be judging other people. You're not going to be projecting anything to onto anybody else. And you're going to be living in an enlightened way. That is, you're not going to be bogged down by that whole process. None of the drama.
Yeah, and also
affect your consciousness.
Yeah, and also very important is that reverse it. You know, our need for belonging, our need for love, our need for acceptance gives tremendous power to somebody else's opinion. And it's real easy to turn yourself over to someone else's expectations. So that's a two-way street that we really have to deal with. Yes, go in non-judgmental, allow them to be who they are, but also don't fall into the trap of you being who they are because of your concern about their judgments for you. So isn't that a two-way street?
Well, it is a two-way street. And if all of that needs to be taken care of. On a relationship level, we want to be people who are aware of how we're interacting with other people. We want to know how they affect us. We really want to be aware of our consciousness in that regard, the give and take of a relationship. We don't want to be swept up by somebody or bowled over by anybody, but we don't want to do that to them either. But the idea of living like a window, working like a mirror, is that you're really stepping back from that whole process. It doesn't mean you're not involved in relationships, but it means that you've moved past the level of making judgments about people. You really do allow them to be just as they are. And because you're watching your own reactions and not reacting to your own emotional reactions, and that's a concept that's important to get, then what other people do aren't going to affect you so much either. You get to be this autonomous being, and that's really the highest level of development human beings can attain, that where you're not really emotionally dependent on people anymore, not dependent on their judgments, you're not making judgments. You're really, your consciousness, your awareness is, it's become pure, it's independent of that anymore, you've become an autonomous being.
Sure, and I think autonomous is a very hard word for most people to conceptualize today. We're so geared to being with people. We're so geared to being in a culture, and a culture has certain rules and regulations. And if you don't fall into those rules and regulations, you're an outcast and you can't fit. And I think that word is probably one of the most important words people live by. You know, where am I going to fit? Where am I going to be recognized? How am I going to create my own identity within what I'm doing, who I'm going to be around, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, there's a long list here. And I really believe that once we can get the concept of what you're talking about, life becomes a whole lot easier.
This book talks a great deal about the development of just what you said, identity and a self. It's what most of life is about for human beings. Who am I? What am I? How do I fit in? These things have survival value, but, you know, it's also what allows us to feel like we exist and that we're distinct from other people, that we're unique, that there's something special about us. In the book, all of evolution really leads up to this structure called the self and its elements, which we think of as identity. You know, I am this, I'm not that. I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Protestant, you know, I'm a Giants fan, I'm a Yankees fan, you know, that kind of thing. All those things that actually are what allows us to think that we're somebody individual. All of that is extremely important to human development. Enlightenment is getting past the influence of that, where you're no longer concerned about identity elements. Instead, what you're just doing is watching those things come up, not attaching to them anymore. You're not a Giants fan anymore. You're not a conservative or a liberal anymore. You're not caught up in the conflicts those people have, the competition. You're just letting all that go by. What you begin to sense is that you're just this observer. So the idea is to be able to participate in life, but not be bogged down in the kind of things we've been talking about, which, if you put it all together, you might call the human drama that, you know, can tend to bog people down.
But it's also, and I'm listening to you, it's also a process, and life is about a process. You want to put a chair together, you start at the legs, you work your way up to the seat, you put the back in. And realistically, that's what we're dealing with. Most people have no idea of how to go about what you're talking about when they start to grow up. There's no classes in school about it. There, you know, the way to find out is you go down, you go out, and you fall down, you get up, and you fall down, you get up, and one day you go, oh, maybe all those things I've thought about all my life are working for me. And then you begin to look, or you get that cathartic moment like you had. And then all of a sudden, life seems to be very different. I really believe what you're talking about is something called wisdom. You can go to school, you can get all of the academic curricula behind you that you possibly want, but nobody's going to teach you how to use it until you get out into the street, quote unquote. And when that intelligence, when that information turns to wisdom, all of a sudden now you've got something that you can ground yourself and you can work with.
Well, there's a readiness factor in this. You know, you have to get to a place where you say, you know, I don't like how things have been going. This living this way is not satisfying to me. And then, you know, we get a gift like the insight I got for this book that is the very kind of instruction book you're talking about. When people are ready to step back and begin to look at things differently, if what they've used hasn't really brought them a happier life or serenity, it may be because being caught up in the normal way of living life isn't. It can only provide those things temporarily.
Yeah.
So then you know, if you're ready, you look for a guide. And in this case, this book is excellent guides. I have read it 18 times. I get something out of it every time.
So it's alive. Yeah. So effectively, it's alive. And when I say it's alive, it's something that you pick up, you read, and each time you read something and you hit that key point for you, you get to a different dimension, you see it a little bit differently, and then you go on, you come back and look at it again, and you've experienced so many things out there, it's going to give you a little deeper perspective of what it is that you're dealing with. And I really believe that the things that work are truly alive. Maybe I'll go through the book, I'll read it the first time, and I will get a certain amount out of it. But what I'll get out of it is about this as much as I'm willing to accept or deal with at the time. I've gone out, I've had some experience, now I can handle a little more, I look at it again, now I see it in a little more depth, and it goes like that. And I really believe, but when you're dealing with, you know, the world in itself and judgment and how to get along with everybody, it's that process again, and it takes doing it and falling down and doing it and falling down, and you keep getting back up until one day, just like you did, you got it, and now it works.
Now it works. Well, we're designed to evolve, and you know, the process, the learning process you described is really how evolution has worked over millennia. And in our personal lives, it is a matter of trying this and seeing how it works, maybe falling down, having, you know, not having much success at it, trying something a little bit different. If you have a guide to work by, you can save probably a lot of steps. You know, what the book provides is guidance both in how to look at things, but it also teaches how to really get calm from inside so that when you're watching what's going on, you don't react to it too much. So, you know, if there is a failure, you don't react to it too much, and you can bounce back a lot more quickly. So there's information there that changes the way people look at things, and there's information there that teaches people how to become calm from the inside in a very, very successful way.
I love every second of that. Mark, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at, buy the book, get more information.
Website is Mark with a K, markcbrown.com. There's a short video there introducing the book. There are blogs I've written, some of them from the book, that people will find very interesting. And there are links there to Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com where people can order print or ebooks. So it's markcbrown.com.
Wonderful. Website. Hey, Mark, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us if you want to join in. 1-888-429-5471. Dave Levinsky with us, an internationally renowned expert in the fields of business planning, exit strategy planning, capital raising, and new venture development. He's appeared on several major networks and in top publications, including CNN Money, Business Week, LA Times, Forbes, Smart Money. A serial entrepreneur, Dave's launched and exited several successful businesses. He's president and co-founder of GrowThink, a consulting firm that has helped over 500,000 entrepreneurs in starting, growing, or selling their own businesses. And we're going to talk about crowdfunding tonight. And let's say, Dave, hi, welcome to the show.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When you talk about crowdfunding, is this, well, let's define that. Let's lay a base. We'll get a model, and then we'll work from there. So when we say crowdfunding, what are we doing?
Sounds good. So with crowdfunding, the definition, as you said, crowdfunding is basically, if you break the word up, the crowd, we talk about the internet crowd or the crowd of people that we all know, and funding is funding. So when you put it together, crowdfunding is raising money or funding from the crowd. So getting people you know, or more so the entire internet crowd, to help fund your either new or existing company.
Now, by the way, one of the greatest examples of that, and you know, like him, dislike him, not to get political, look what Obama did in 2008. Look at what he did to get that election. The different places that he created the funding from, people with $10 a piece, $5 a piece, $25 a piece. He actually did what you're talking about and was phenomenal at it. We don't have to like him or dislike him, but that's a great example of what you're talking about.
It is a great example. And what's really interesting about crowdfunding, if you take it and using the Obama example, is that when you fund something, it's one thing to like somebody or say that you like someone publicly. When you fund somebody, you then become a supporter of that person or that company that you funded. And what happens naturally is that you start telling your friends and you start promoting that person. That's exactly what happened in the Obama example, is that people that funded Obama became his most fervent supporters and were the people that spread the word and essentially marketed for him. And that's what's really exciting about crowdfunding for your business, is that if you get people to fund you from the crowd, they're then going to tell their friends, families, colleagues, et cetera, about you, and they're going to do the same thing to market your business. So it's a great example, Michael, of it in use in politics, and it also can be something that you can use for a for-profit business or even a nonprofit business. We've probably seen, you know, Wikipedia. That's how Wikipedia raises millions of dollars each year, essentially from donations or crowdfunding.
Oh, absolutely. No question about that. And we really look at the economy today. Obviously, we've got businesses and marketers. They're all budget crunch. You know what the economy is like, so you do more in less time, less money. Because the economy's slumping now, consumers are starting to spend less. So how do you get that money behind you to be able to do what you have to do? And you're talking about a missing link. And I really believe exactly, Dave, what you're dealing with here is that missing link to establish the dollars to create that foundation to be able to go out and do what you have to do.
Exactly. Not only do I believe that, and do you believe that, but the United States government clearly believes that as well, and they're in the process of trying to pass what's known as the Entrepreneur Access to Capital Act, which is essentially to allow crowdfunding to be even more widespread. And right now, there's different types of crowdfunding. One type of crowdfunding, which is not yet fully legal through the eyes of the SEC, is equity-based crowdfunding, which is basically crowdfunding dollars and getting equity in return in that venture, which is just yet another level of crowdfunding.
Now, by the way, one of the great examples of using something, and most people have no concept how to use it, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. My goodness, you're talking about hundreds of millions of people all over the globe that if they see the right thing, if there's that fit, then all of a sudden you've got somebody participating with you. Years ago, it was that 6 degrees of separation. If you knew somebody who knew somebody, maybe get 50, 100 people out there on the same page. If you have the right message, my goodness, look what was it, Facebook in the last couple of days, how many hundreds of millions of people are involved, and they don't even have a product. What they do is connect, which is their product.
Correct. And that's what makes crowdfunding so exciting and so relevant today is that, as you said, it used to be 6 degrees of separation, and it was also slow. So if I wanted to get in touch with you and I didn't know you, I could probably do it, but it would take me a long time, and it would be a series of phone calls. Now, with the right message, I can instantaneously get in touch with someone like you possibly or a lot of other people. So that makes it really, really exciting. We talk about this global economy and how everything's gotten closer. It is through tools, as you mentioned, like Facebook, like Twitter. Now, I would like to talk about crowdfunding in that regard and really specify the two main types of crowdfunding so everyone understands that, because for one type of crowdfunding, you still can't use tools like Twitter and Facebook. And so let me just clarify, if you don't mind. There are two types of crowdfunding for the most part. One is what I call equity-based crowdfunding, which is traditional equity investing, which means if I have a company, you give me $100 and I give you, let's say, one share of my company, and you now have own equity in my company. Now, the issue with equity-based crowdfunding, and that's what this Entrepreneurs Access to Capital Act is all about, that's in the Senate right now, is they want to allow companies and entrepreneurs to raise equity-based crowdfunding. It's very exciting. Right now, one of the main limitations of equity-based crowdfunding is that you're not allowed to what's called general solicitation, which means this: I can't go out there to the internet and say, "Hey, everybody, invest in my private company," or I can't stand outside of a Walmart and when people leave say, "Hey, invest in my private company." For a public company, rules are different, and that's why public companies are under extreme scrutiny and have to do a lot of fines. But for a private company, you're not allowed to do that. You need to have what we call an existing and pre-existing relationship. And so if the government approves this Entrepreneurs Access to Capital Act, one of the key things that they're going to remove is that limitation, which now will allow an entrepreneur to actually go and solicit anybody. And so that's a key thing that the entrepreneurs need to know right now, is that right now, as of this moment, you cannot do equity-based crowdfunding to that extent, because once again, you need a pre-existing relationship. However, there's a whole other side or type of crowdfunding, which I call reward or donation-based crowdfunding, which you can do because you're bypassing the SEC and the government, because you're not issuing equity. You're not giving shares in your company. So the way reward or donation-based crowdfunding works is that you raise, let's say you give me money for my venture, and I give you something in return. Now, in return, it could be, if it was straight donation, I could put you on my website as a donor, and you get the satisfaction knowing that. What's working very, very well is rewards-based, whereby I give you some sort of reward so for funding me. So, for example, if I want to create a new company and I'm going to create a product that I'm later going to sell for $100, I could say, hey, if you give me $75 donations now, when the product's ready, that $100 product, I'll give that to you later at no cost, because essentially you're prepaying me now. So, you know, a lot of companies are successfully raising crowdfunding that way, by giving out these rewards. And what's so exciting about that from an entrepreneurial perspective is that what you're doing is market research. And most ventures fail for two reasons. One is that they don't raise enough capital, so they lose, they run out of money. Or two, it's just a bad business idea and they thought there was a market demand and there is not. So what's exciting here is that you're able now through rewards-based crowdfunding to figure out if there actually is demand for your product or service. So if you can't sell a certain number of units of your product at a discount, once again, for example, let's say I'm going to create a $100 product and I'm offering it now for just $75. If I can't sell that to people, then maybe I don't have a business in the first place. So that's what's so exciting. You're testing the market and doing market research, and you're raising money for your venture all in one. And if you're able to do that, you pretty much have a winner on your hands, because you have the funding to grow, and you know that you have this you've done this customer research, and customers have come back and said, yes, we want it. And as I mentioned earlier, the people that do fund you, most likely they're going to tell their friends and everyone about you, because they're going to be excited to be the ones to say, hey, I was in the ground floor of this company, because everyone wants to be able to say, hey, I was one of the early investors in Facebook or Google or whatever company. It's very, very exciting to the people that fund you.
Okay, so it's not necessarily a not-for-profit, a 501(c), but what it is, and stop me if I'm wrong here, what I'm hearing you say is, sure, if I create a company, it's a research company. It's not a marketing company. It's not a company to do business right now to get money back in. What we're doing is we're testing the market for future sales.
That's one aspect of crowdfunding. It's one way you can use it. You can use crowdfunding for a nonprofit as well, and use the crowdfunding. There are certain platforms online that aid in your ability to market. So right now, you know, any nonprofit can essentially put a PayPal donate now button on their website, and they can go online and they could, you know, tweet it, and they go on Facebook, and they can do that right now. There are some platforms that are arising that are making sites like Kickstarter.com and Rocket Hub and some other ones specifically for nonprofits that make it easier for you to spread the word and accept donations and publicize those donations. So that for nonprofits, you can do that. For what I find most exciting about crowdfunding is what I was mentioning about sort of new companies. If you're looking to start a new product or service company, you can use crowdfunding to, at the same time, raise money and do this market research to confirm that there's true market demand for what you're doing.
I think another area of consideration, too, and I think it's very important, it's that, you know, the old industry approaches of marketing aren't working anymore. They're dying out. We've got a net generation here. We've got the baby boomers that grew up with digital technology and yada, 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 and also all about collaboration, which is what we're talking about with sourcing. And it's an entirely different marketing program to reach an entirely different crowd out there today. And if you do not know the language, no matter what you have to offer, nothing's going to happen.
Agreed. There's, you know, it's about, it is still classic marketing, figuring out who your target customers are, what is the best way to reach them, how do you need to speak to them, what's the message that's going to resonate, and how do you get them excited. And a lot of times, you're able to do that with your product. Your product or service speaks for itself. You look at a Google, when people start using Google and seeing how great it worked, they start telling people, same with Facebook, it naturally spread virally. However, most companies don't have that built in. They don't have that, you know, built into the product or service that this is just an absolute winner, really exciting thing. And that's why for the rest of us, we need to have that clear message that speaks to our market so that they want to get involved and they want to support us.
No, absolutely. No question about it. And I think when it really comes down to the essence of everything, you know, there's an old example of a drill in the hole. You know, the question would be rhetorically, you know, if you want a hole in the wall at home, you go to the hardware store to get a drill, which is going to make the hole. Are you buying the drill? You're buying the hole. You're not buying the drill. You're buying what the drill can do, which happens to be the hole. The hole happens to be a solution to a problem that somebody is that somebody has, a challenge or whatever. And I really believe in today's world, most people are missing the mark because they're not framing the marketing in such a way that it's a solution for what somebody is looking for. It's not the drill. It's not the car. It's not the whatever. It's what it's going to do for you. And I really believe that's the key. And most people, Dave, are missing that mark.
I completely agree with you. And it's also, you know, another way of looking at what we call marketing myopia, which is, you know, really just leveraging what you're saying is the, you know, the railroad companies, they were in the business of transportation, but they didn't see what you're talking about. They didn't see that the goal is not to be riding in a car or a train. Your goal is to get from point A to point B. And if the, you know, railroad companies would have recognized that, they would have invested heavily, you know, in newer technologies like automobiles, and we'd be living in a different world right now. So you got to be, as an entrepreneur or a small business owner or a large business owner, you need to be looking at what you're saying, which is the solution, not just the widget that's going to, you know, get you the solution, but what is the solution that your customers desire, and you need to speak in those terms. That's a great point.
Yeah, and no question about it. And when we really come down to it, and I don't want to belabor this, we're starting to run out of time, and I don't want to take the focus off where you're at with this, but this word solution, you know, you got coaches and trainers all over the place saying solution, 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 get them to feel it, and yada, yada. But there's so much more. There's an internal dynamic that occurs with all of this. And when you talk about solution, you get up in the morning, and by the time you do your day and you go to bed at night, your entire world is built in and around solution. I would ask, and I won't ask, I'll ask and answer. You don't have to answer this. If I were to say to you, are you married? And you said to me, yes. And I would say to you, not who is your wife, what is your wife? Most people don't have an answer. She's beautiful. She's wonderful. But no, she is a solution. She fills you up with something that if she wasn't there, you wouldn't have. So she's an answer. She's a solution. You didn't fall in love with her. You fall in love with the way she made you feel. Five women could be standing there, and she's the one who triggers it. Your house is a solution. Your car is a solution. Your occupation is a solution. This goes on and on. And we don't really consciously realize how solution-oriented or driven that we are. And when something is set up, it has to be set up in such a way that your target audience, whoever that is putting their problem on the solution you have to offer, and you create your entire marketing around the problems that your target market has. And that in and of itself is very simple, but they miss it, Dave. They miss it.
I agree with you. Once again, tying it back to crowdfunding, even more, what's exciting is this market research aspect, because you can put up your product or service or company and start, you know, tweeting people about it or using Facebook and saying, hey, here's what we're doing. Would you fund me? And if they come to your page and you don't present a solution, they're not going to fund you. They're not going to be interested. So you need to position your company, product, service, et cetera, as a solution to somebody's needs, and it will be successful. And, you know, we're seeing solutions all the time. I was just actually thinking about that this morning when I went over to my Keurig coffee machine and was able to, you know, make a cup of coffee in 30 seconds or so. The solution was saving me time versus, you know, a traditional coffee maker.
No question about it. And by the way, when the show is over and you see your wife, you run up and you give her a kiss on the cheek and say, hello, you gorgeous solution, you.
Okay. We'll see. I'll get back to you on how that one works out.
Okay. Dave, we're about out of time. Website we can find you at?
Sure. My company's website is growthink.com, growthink.com. We also have crowdfundingformula.com for those of you that are interested specifically in learning more about how crowdfunding works and how you can use it to raise money for your venture.
Dave, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I appreciate it. You're spot on with what you have.
I appreciate that, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After. Oh, listen to the switch in mood. I like it.
Once upon a time,
a girl... Dr. Amir Levine, MD, with us, the co-author of Attached, The New Science of Adult Attachment and How It Can Help You Find and Keep Love. He's an adult and child adolescent psychiatrist, a neuroscientist, graduated from the with residency program from New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University. He's currently a principal investigator on a research program sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, and he has a private practice in New York City where he lives with his family. And let us say, Amir, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
Oh, by the way, thank you so much for being here. Attachment is a very interesting word. It can either bring you towards or push you away from something. The word attachment, where was this word? Where did it trigger that something in you that caused you to create what we have here?
So, you know, when I first encountered attachment from a therapeutic perspective was in the therapeutic nursery at Columbia when I was a resident. I was doing attachment therapy with mothers and kids. And it was such a powerful therapy that I got so interested in it. So I started reading everything that I could about attachment. And then I discovered that there's a whole field of adult attachment, of how we behave in our adult romantic relationships. There's a whole science behind it. And I thought it sort of blew me away. And so that's when I decided to start to write this book. So because there's nothing there for the lay people. There's nothing there for the general audience to understand how their attachments and how their attachment styles affect their behaviors.
Now, by the way, when we talk about attachment styles, what is it that we recognize in someone that causes us to attach? I mean, it could be something miserable about yourself, something that's been plaguing you your entire life, causing you to be crippled in some areas and not being able to move forward. And at the same time, this is what you draw to you. So does the book allow us to recognize what the attachment is, good or bad, and then to make the decision whether to stay there or not?
Right, right, exactly. So I think the book starts with the sort of explaining the premise that people have a hard time sometimes with the idea that if they attach to someone, they become dependent on them. But the book, like the way that we started, we basically say, you know, you can forget about this whole idea of staying independent in a relationship. Dependency is a fact. It's just a biological fact. There's no way around it. We're hardwired to be dependent on our significant other. So if that's the fact, if we become thoroughly dependent on someone else, it becomes really crucial to choose the right person to depend on.
Okay, so in essence, you're saying that the attachment, the dependency is innate, then it's going to be there no matter what you do, but you have to be careful with who you're with because it can backfire on you.
It can make a huge, huge difference in your life, basically. Because if you're in a good attachment, you know, it's not just psychological. It's also from a physiological perspective. There's all these amazing studies that show that if you have a good attachment, your health even is much better. If you have a cut, for example, one study, they looked at the healing rate of the wound. If you have a cut and you're in a good relationship, your cut will heal faster. So that's the level of dependency that I'm talking about. It's so ingrained in us.
Okay, so in essence, with cuts healing, the emotions obviously affect the immune system. The immune system is responsible for healing that cut, quote unquote. And if your emotions are stable, there's balance there, then, quote unquote, the cut heals faster. So in essence, yes. it's all got to do with getting this balance in your life.
Exactly. So it's all about the balance. So then how do you go about finding the right person for you, the right person to depend on? And luckily, science has answers for that. And it all has to do with your attachment style and the attachment style of the other person.
Okay.
And three attachment styles.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to get into that. Now, the three attachment styles, how did you develop those?
So we did not develop these. These are basically a product of decades of research. And at first, they were discovered in children and in their relationship with their caregivers. And they described three attachment styles: anxious, avoidant, and secure. And then in 1987, two researchers, Hazen and Shaver, said, you know, we really think it's like the very similar system in our brain works also in adult romantic relationships, that we attach to our adult partner in similar ways in which we attach as children. So they decided to examine whether these attachment styles are important in adulthood, and they found that was the case. That started 20 years of research in adult attachment, and that's where we basically derived those attachment styles: anxious, avoidant, and secure.
Okay, so in essence, when we meet somebody, and we have one, let's say I'm the secure type, but I meet somebody who is the anxious type. Obviously, we are not going to become a fit no matter what we do. But what is it? And you said that it's automatic within us. Does it set off a chemical reaction in the brain? Does that chemical reaction in the brain cause a behavior? And that causes the stress and the trauma. Or when we meet somebody that we are a fit with, those chemicals that are released are calming and they allow you to move forward.
Okay, so the way it works, it's a remarkably simple blueprint. If you think, that's why we like this subject matter so much, because it's very intuitive. So if you're anxious, it's not just anxiety about the world in general. It's, you have this tendency to want to be very close to someone, to want to be very intimate, but then you also tend to worry a lot about not being loved back. And you're very sensitive to little things that happen in the relationship, and you tend to protest. So that's the anxious. And if you're secure, you're very warm and loving. You love to be close. You love to be intimate. But you don't worry a lot about not being loved back. And you're pretty easygoing. And then the last one, the avoidant, again, you also want to be in a relationship because we said that we're all hardwired to be dependent and attached. But something funny happens when you get closer in the relationship. You start feeling uncomfortable with too much intimacy and closeness, and you start pushing your partner, putting them at arm's length. You really have this idea that you have to maintain your independence, and you feel not too comfortable with too much closeness. So these are the three attachment styles. And there's two of them, the anxious and the avoidant, that if they get together, that's a huge mismatch. And that actually really, that's where a lot of the relationship drama lies, in the anxious avoidant. We call it the anxious avoidant trap, really.
Okay, so, but effectively, what I'm hearing, and stop me if I'm wrong, Amir, but we're hardwired for this.
Right. But the beauty about attachment styles is that we're hardwired, but also we have the ability to change. You know, we're very malleable species as humans. We're very adaptable, especially to social situations. So actually, we can become more secure, but it happens more in the setting. And so there are various ways of becoming more secure, and that's what we really are trying to sort of, that's one of our biggest messages in Attach, is that you can become more secure. Now, the easiest way to become more secure is if you get together with someone who is secure. So if you're anxious and avoidant, and you get together with someone secure, they will make you more secure. We actually, in the process of writing this book, we fell in love with the secures. Because we like to call them the supermates of evolution. They're amazing in relationships. They're just amazing.
Now, by the way, and you say in the book, I've got the book in front of me, page 219, that you see, I've memorized the entire thing here. But you talk about effective communication. when we talk about communication, communication is not just talking to someone. It's the response you get from that person. And communication is not something that is innate within us. We say the words, but that doesn't mean that we can have that other person understand it in the way that we meant it. That is a learned process.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and that's the thing is, I think that's the latter part of the book, really, we interviewed a lot of secure people because we wanted to know what is their secret, what is this talent all about. And so we came up with a lot of different things that they do. They do it instinctively, but there's a method behind it. And we came up with some of their secrets and how are they so great in relationships. And I think one of the first thing, actually, that I think a lot of secure people have that they automatically seem to know is that their partner well-being is their well-being. That's almost like an axiom that they live according to. That's a core belief that they have. So they know that they have to take care of their partner because basically their well-being is also, if they're happy, they're happy. I think some people say happy wife, happy life. So they seem to know that innately. And that's very, very important.
Okay. You know, it would be very interesting if somebody met somebody and they began to fall in love and they decided to get married, if they could go through a process of getting not just a license to say you're married, but a license to be able to move through and a school to go to and a class to say, here are the pitfalls, here's the good stuff, here's how to change it. And, I mean, this list goes on and on. But we don't have that. Most people will search what you have after the problem starts. So there's got to be a way to get it before the problem starts. There's got to be an opening, some kind of a communication area that people can come to and learn more and more about how good a relationship that they can have.
So I think the first way to do it, actually, is to find the right match for you. Because let's say, and that's actually a lot of people don't really know that because they don't know about attachment and they don't know about the science. But if you're going out on a date and let's say you're anxious or avoidant, My suggestion will be to steer clear. If you're anxious, to steer clear of someone who's avoidant. Or if you're avoidant, to steer clear of someone who's anxious, because you really are, it's really a big, big mismatch. You are really bringing out the worst in one another. I mean, if you think about it, one wants a lot of intimacy and a lot of closeness, but they often are really worried that the other person is not going to be able to give it to them. And the other wants to maintain a distance and pushes the other person away all the time. So they really get into this really vicious cycle. So one of the things that we actually make a very strong point is that if you're in that position, if you're just starting and you're dating someone, to really learn how to recognize what your attachment style is and to learn how to listen and to recognize what other people's attachment styles are and to navigate your relationship world like that. But a lot of people, not only do they not know that, they do, because of sort of relationship behaviors and dating behaviors, they actually achieve the opposite.
Okay, so let's say you meet, you know, a couple of people meet each other, they get in a relationship, and then they sit down and they realize that there are strategies to use, there are certain styles that you become, and your behavior is different. What if you get somebody who's anxious and tied up with somebody who's avoidant? Once you get to that place, now how do you, and I know this is a very, it sounds simple, but not a simple fix to this. How do you fix it? How do you move through it?
That's a good question. You know, it's not simple at all. It's very hard work because both sides, again, oftentimes in those, that's why we call it the anxious avoidant trap, because both sides really sort of, what's important for them, they really, it's hard for them to move away from that insecurity into something more secure. They're really stuck in their patterns, and they need a secure role model. That's what happens when you're in a relationship with someone secure. You have a secure role model, but they don't have that role model. So they keep, one takes more distance, one needs more, one calls more and sort of protests more. So it becomes really difficult. So the way to do it is to find other secure role models outside of the relationship. And it can be either in counseling, or it can just be thinking about when you get into a fight, first of all, is really understanding what your attachment style is and what you're really trying to convey. And then also understanding that you're trying to look, to search inside you for a more secure role model. We all have different role models inside us. And sort of to think, okay, I know this person either is a grandparent, parents or people that you know in your life, how would they react to this? How would they behave? And this is like the first step towards more security. But it's very, very hard to do that in that connection. I mean, I can give you an example. Let's say your partner is going away, your wife is going away to the airport. And let's say she's avoidant, and you see that the weather is not good, and then you try to call her, but she's going on a business trip, and she's like talking on the phone with someone else, and she doesn't have the time, and she sees your call, and she pushes ignore. If you're anxious, you're like, what's going on? I really need to make sure that she's okay, and you'll try to call again and again, and then by that time, she might get irritated and just turn off the phone. So by the time she calls you, when she gets to her destination, you'd be really upset, and you'll start a huge fight. But if the other person going to the airport was secure, they usually what they would do, they would text you from the cab. They would text you before the plane takes off. They would text you after the plane lands. And you'll never even feel the anxiety, not even the beginning of it. And so when you talk to them on the phone, everything is fine. And you take this particular scenario and you multiply it 10,000 times and you get the idea between the difference between a secure relationship and an insecure relationship.
And by the way,
it only takes a few seconds to text.
Absolutely. Now, by the way, the other side of that, Amir, is this, that, and we're starting to run out of time, but very important, you can use this also in business. It's like your co-author, Rachel Heller. Can you do business with someone if you're not a right fit?
That's brilliant, actually. I'm glad you brought up this point, because attachment styles don't start and end only in our romantic relationships. They also really play an important role in business and the way that we relate to people who work with us and also with friends. But once we understand what attachment style they have, and we can actually manage better. So if you don't know what these attachment styles are and you don't know, then you're really like basically walking in the dark. But if you really educate yourself about attachment styles, you really get a better blueprint of how to handle all these situations.
Oh, no question about it. Now, we're out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Oh, definitely. People can go to our book's website, which is attachedthebook.com, www.attachedthebook.com, and they can find out more about the book.
Great. And Amir, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
You love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all, oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all, oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Toll free, call us if you want to join in. 888-429-5471. That's 888-429-5471. Sought after speaker, broadcast segment host Conrad Toner, CFP-CLU, has educated countless clients, listeners, and readers on living on retirement that they've always wanted without financial stress or anxiety. His latest book is Fearless Retirement, How to Retire Without Financial Worry. And let's say, Conrad, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, hello, Michael.
Thank you so much for being here. You know, I will bet any amount of money that, Conrad, that question, how to retire without financial worry, runs through 90% of the people who are just about ready to retire or have just started to retire because of this economy. If you've got the magic answer, I imagine everybody would love to hear that, Conrad.
Well, you're absolutely right, Michael. It's the number one question that people want to know, and there's been lots of surveys and studies done in the last couple of years that are actually showing how people are more afraid of running out of money in retirement than they are of dying, which really says a lot.
Oh, no question. And, you know, and the big question also is, you know, is what I'm making now, what I'm going to retire on now, what I've set up, was that going to be enough to handle what the bills are? You know, gas right now is almost $4 a gallon, going up to $5, and hopefully not this summer. But we don't know what that's going to be like in 4 or 5 years from now. And if gas goes up, that means food goes up. And, I mean, this list goes on and on. So that, quote-unquote, $1,000 that I have to live on may cost me $3,000 in 3 years, 5 years from now, and I've still got my $1,000. Where do I go from there?
Well, you're bang on with that, and that's just one of seven major risks that any boomer or person who's going to retire in the next 5 to 10 years is going to have to worry about. That's inflation, but there's a lot of other things they need to address, and what's really missing is having a plan and identifying what these challenges are and creating a solution for it, and that's what people are missing.
Yeah, when we really come down to it, you know, there was, the term asset allocation. There was a time when that was a decent tool to use. You know, a little bit of investment here, some investment there, real estate here. But things have changed as far as the worth and the value of things. So that doesn't necessarily work anymore. There's no guarantee. So what we really need when it comes down to it, Conrad, we need a roadmap from somebody who's been there, done that, to say, okay, here's the pitfalls. And here's the road to get there that, for the most part, you can avoid the pitfalls.
Well, and that's exactly what I've been doing and counseling my clients for the last 15 years, is creating that roadmap or financial plan, if you will. And that's what I was motivated to do with my book. I found with the last major market correction back in 2008 and 2009, so many people were faced with a system that failed them, and that was asset allocation. They felt that, you know, the old school was put a certain amount of money in bonds and cash and the other amount in equities, and you'd be okay. Well, everything corrected in 2008 and 2009, so there was a lot of devastation out there. So it's time for a new approach, and part of what I teach clients is something called product allocation, which is very different than asset allocation, and that seems to be the way to go going forward here.
Now, when we look at this, and we look at, again, this economy, which we have no idea what's going to happen in 20 minutes from now, what do I do? We talk product allocation. How do we find the best product? How do we find something that can sustain whatever it is that we've financially we put into it that will take care of the quote-unquote golden years?
Well, you really have to step back first and take a look at, well, what's the difference between asset allocation and product allocation? Asset allocation is where you have different types of financial instruments like cash and equities and bonds. And think of it like being in one big bucket. And when you go to draw an income, you hope that those things are all working together and stirring up in that pot and bucket. And when you turn on the tap, you get the income that you need. But we've seen that that doesn't work. Product allocation looks at several separate pots to put different products in. So you may have one product pot called annuities, which is a life annuity guaranteed by an insurance company that will provide you income no matter what the markets do. Another pot will have managed money that could use asset allocation as part of its strategy, and you would use what's called a systematic withdrawal out of that pot of money. And then the third pot would be something called a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit plan. And this is a relatively new kind of product. But the key here is that each one of those pots has a separate tap, and they work independently of one another rather than the asset allocation pot where everything is kind of mixed up together.
No, okay,
does that
so
make sense?
Oh, I'm sorry, but when we look at this, Conrad, can you give us something practical? When I say practical, create an image for that. What is it that we, what you're saying, if somebody was actually doing that, what would they do to do that?
Well, what they would do is they would take a look at all of the assets that they have, all of the savings, their 401ks, their, you know, IRAs, everything that they've saved up for retirement, and they'd step back first and figure out, well, what is it that I am going to be spending in retirement? So you have to get that number. You have to try to figure out how much are you going to be spending, first of all. Then you have to take a look at what sources of income do you have that are coming in that are somewhat guaranteed, like your Social Security pension. Maybe you have a pension coming from, you know, a workplace pension. And then you take a look at those two numbers, and you subtract the expenses from the income that you know you're going to have coming in, and you come up with what I call a gap. And then you simply have to take the investments that you've set aside for your retirement and figure out from those which types of products, whether it's annuities or a combination of annuities and systematic withdrawal benefits, that you can invest in that can create that income to fill the gap. So let's say, as an example, you want to...
Please.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. We get just a little bit of a delay, but go ahead, finish out, please.
Okay, say for an example, you have a gap that you need to fill that's $20,000 in income that you need to generate, and you have, you know, a couple of $100,000, maybe $300,000 in your retirement savings plans. You may take $100,000 of that and buy an annuity that will generate, say, $8,000 or $9,000. Then you might take another $100,000 of that savings and put it into a systematic withdrawal plan with managed money that you can control the amount of income coming out of that to make up another, say, $10,000, and then use the third part of the product allocation and put $50,000 or $60,000 of your money into a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, which is a variable annuity in technical terms. So when you add those three things up, you will get that $20,000 of income that you've identified.
See, Conrad, in today's world, you know, if you were sued, you would not go to court without an attorney. You'd be crazy not to. And in this world, when we are talking about retirement, you don't do it by yourself. There are areas that you don't know. So you go to somebody like you who, quote unquote, you've been there, you've done that. You teach clients how to do what it takes to protect themselves. Because truly what we're talking about here, one word, it boils down to survival. And I really believe if somebody's trying to do it by themselves in today's world, they're going to be in major trouble. So that's why guys like you, realistically, this is a window of opportunity, because there's a lot of people who need to be held by the hand right now, and there's no question about that.
Well, absolutely. And the problem there is that there's a lot of guys who call themselves and women who call themselves financial planners and financial advisors, yet they're really just in the game to make commissions and money. So if you're going to make this leap to retirement, when you do that, you really want to make sure that you take care of one of the biggest risks out there, and that's what I've coined as financial advisor risk. And that is, you know, you have to find that trustworthy person who actually knows what they're doing. And, you know, I mean, we can look at a case like Bernie Madoff, you know, a number of years ago. People trusted him, and they went to him by referral, but turns out he wasn't an actual licensed financial advisor at all.
No.
And so he was able to steal billions of dollars from people.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Thank goodness he got caught. But the problem is the Bernie Madoffs of this world, and there are not that many of them, my goodness. You know, to some degree, there are people out there. They give everybody else in the industry a bad name. They cause, quote-unquote, fear and panic in the hearts of those people that they have their money out there. You know, the people who lost their money, was horrible. I mean, they lived all of their life. They worked hard. They did whatever they did. They lost their life savings, quote-unquote, and then some. So the Madoffs of this world are out there. There's no question. But everybody's not a Madoff. And I think that we really get to get, have to get that point across to everybody out there. Because when you really come down to it, the one or two bad apples, they don't represent the entire field.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and they're the ones that make the media. But there are a lot of really excellent people in this industry, and you just have to figure out how to do that, how to figure out how you can find those people, because not all financial advisors, as good as they are at helping people accumulate money for the future, not every advisor knows how to create retirement income plans. And that's the challenge, and that's the other level of financial risk, is not dealing with a person who's actually trained and qualified to help you spend your money in retirement. They've been great at helping you save it.
Oh, sure. Now, what about, and there's something that you've created, it's called the spending funnel. What is that? How does it work? And how do people take advantage of something like that?
Well, the retirement spending funnel is actually something I've created that's based on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And what it does is it's a tool that helps people determine different types of spending that they're going to have in retirement. And it breaks it down to five different categories of spending based on psychological and social needs that you have. And what it's meant to do is help you kind of categorize your lifestyle into expense categories rather than just trying to sit down and do a budget, which, you know, most people just, they would hate to have to sit down and do that. So this brings a little bit of a human touch to categorizing your expenses so that you can actually then match the sources of assets and income you have to those expenses, determine where the gap is and how you're going to fill it.
Okay, so in essence, you really have to, if you can see it and you have a roadmap, it's got to lend to some semblance of comfort anyway. But what I'm hearing you say is just like doing business. You project out. You strategize and you departmentalize. And I think that's what you're basically saying here.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to kind of take a look at where are you today. Where do you want to be in the future in terms of your retirement, and what do you want to be doing? And that's where the spending funnel kind of comes in. It helps you kind of quantify, well, what is it that I'm going to want to be doing and how much is it going to cost me? Because not knowing how much your retirement is going to cost you is the thing that gives most people the fear, because if you don't know what it's going to cost, you really have no idea whether you can afford it.
Oh, no question. And it's the what it's going to cost, really, it's really where it comes down to. People are frightened to death to let go of a dollar, and I would blame, quote-unquote, I don't like the word, but I would blame the media for the most part, because all of those messages of fear, because, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and that's what they're talking about, and they got people frightened to death of putting a dollar out if they can't control it today, and something's got to be done about that.
Well, and that's why I've always said, you know, who says you can't afford to retire? It's the media that's saying you have to have this huge amount of money set aside. There's these rules of thumb that the industry's come up with that say you must have this amount of income in retirement. Well, you know, it's different for every person, and that's why I've created the tools to help people determine, well, what really am I going to be spending in retirement in my case based on the lifestyle that I'm going to kind of envision for the future?
Oh, sure. Now, Conrad, we're running out of time now. Is there a website we can find you at, find the book, and do you do consultations on the phone?
I do consultations on the phone. I'm creating a whole online kind of coaching program that will be launched here, hopefully, in the next quarter this year. But the website is fearlessretirementbook.com. That's where you can get all the information on the book.
Okay, wonderful. And when you launch the program, yell at us and we'll put you back on the air and we'll talk about it.
Okay, that'll be great. I look forward to it. And thank you so much for having me tonight.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Take care. Good night.
Okay, good night.
Off comes the makeup